Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the National Judicial College. This is another opportunity for the court to conduct oral arguments away from our primary homes in Carson City and in the new courthouse in Las Vegas, and extend some additional exposure to the Judicial College. And next Tuesday, we'll be located in the Boyd Law School, as a matter of fact, for arguments down there. I'd like to welcome all of you here. I want to express my appreciation to the lawyers who accommodate the court's traveling roadshow. At least you folks weren't hauled to Ely like we did when we started this process. But Mr. Petty and Marilee, welcome. Glad to have you here. We ordinarily will begin our arguments by asking lawyers to describe what the facts are in the case, but I think given the nature of this case, that will be abundantly clear as part of the arguments anyway. So I'm going to ask counsel to just first introduce themselves and then proceed with the argument. Following argument, we will invite all of you to pose some questions, if you wish, to the justices as well as to the lawyers about the legal profession, the justice system. We can't talk about the case, and their opportunity to have talked about the case will have ended. But I urge you to ask some questions of these counsel. They're excellent lawyers, and part of the reason we selected this case was because of its subject matter, but also because you'll hear some of the finest lawyers in Washoe County arguing this case today. So with that said, I'd like to begin. Mr. Petty, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. All right.
For the record, this is Andrews versus State, case number 71214.
Thank you, and if I may introduce myself first. My name is John Petty. I'm Chief Deputy with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant in this action, Ryan Andrews. Do you want to begin? As I indicated, my name is John Petty. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Andrews. This is a case that involves, for the court's consideration, the concept of unitive prosecution. And to understand that concept in the context of these facts, I'll just briefly run through them. In this particular case, the City of Sparks, the City of Reno, have consolidated drug narcotics force. They secured the services of a confidential informant to go to Mr. Andrews' house to purchase some drugs. At the house, he sold the confidential informant some grams of methamphetamine and some grams of heroin in separate containers. The confidential informant left after about 25 minutes and out of sight, was contacted by law enforcement, but then thereafter, because Mr. Andrews stepped outside, arrested Mr. Andrews, and then based on the cell and the arrest, they obtained a search warrant from a judge and went back to search the house. Same day, shortly after the arrest. In the house, they again found some heroin and some methamphetamine. They found methamphetamine in the kitchen, in a kitchen drawer, and also a small quantity in the bedroom. The heroin was in the kitchen drawer as well. The state initially charged Mr. Andrews with a variety of counts with regards to the two charges, but ultimately, after motion practice, the way it was charged was the state combined the collective grams of methamphetamine and heroin to charge one count of a level two trafficking in a controlled substance.
Now, just so I understand, as I recall, there was less than 14 grams of heroin combined and less than 14 grams of the methamphetamine combined, is that correct?
That's correct. If you take the methamphetamine from the cell and combine it with the methamphetamine that was found in the house, you had 9.532 grams of a controlled substance. When you took the heroin that was in the house and you added that to the heroin that was part of the cell, you had 9.445 grams of heroin, 9.1 of which reaches the threshold level of a level 2 trafficking offense, both of which do reach the level of a level 1 trafficking offense. And in this case, the state combined those 2 gram amounts for a total that exceeded the amount necessary for a level 2 trafficking charge.
I think we understand the consequences of that, but the audience may not. So I'll interrupt your argument to just state what is the significance of the difference in weights. Why does it make a difference in this case?
Should I address it to you or should I address the audience?
Why don't you address it to us for purposes of the mic being able to pick you up?
Thank you, Your Honor. The significance is this. In Nevada, you can be charged with simple possession of a controlled substance. But if you have a controlled substance that is of varying weights, the penalties become much, much, much greater. So for a level 1 trafficking offense, which I think is between 4 and whatever grams, your potential penalty is a 1 to 6 years in prison and a fairly significant fine. If you are convicted of a level 2 offense, that penalty increases to 2 to 15 years. And if you have a level 3 offense, the penalty can include a life sentence. So, The larger the amount of controlled substance in your possession, the greater potential penalty that you face. My concern in this particular case is that we believe that if you look at the appropriate unit of prosecution, Mr. Andrews was criminally liable for possession, 2 counts of level 1 possession, or 2 counts carrying a sentence of 1 to 6, which theoretically, he was eligible for concurrent sentencing, and if you look at the sentencing that took place below, there's a good chance he could have gotten concurrent sentencing, so 2 1-to-6 sentences, as opposed to a 3-to-8 sentence by virtue of being convicted of the 1 level 2 trafficking offense. So part of my argument is designed to hope give him an opportunity to get a better sentence.
But Mr. Petty, if I may, in this instance, aggregating went to the detriment of the defendant. But there's any other numbers of instances where it could be to their benefit. For instance, if there were 3 different drugs at 6 apiece, or 18. Now you're looking at 3 to 18 as opposed to 2 to 15. So if we adopt your rule, that could eventually not be to the benefit of the defendant.
It could not be for the benefit of other individuals out there, that's true. It could still work to the benefit of my client who I represent today. There is always the possibility that you could have somebody out there who has a quantity of controlled substance that is less than a level, two different controlled substances that is less than a trafficking charge, where that person would be simply convicted of regular possession charges, which carries potential probation. But combining them takes them over the threshold level to a level 1 trafficking offense. I mean, there are scenarios out there. So if you agree with me, they may in some instances work against the interest of the defendant. But today, since I represent Mr. Andrews, I'm concerned about what can benefit him. On the unit of prosecution, Justice Stiglitz, I suggest to you that the statute doesn't specifically say to the prosecutor, thou shalt not combine these offenses. But if you read the statutes, you can see that that's the implication. So, for example, if you start with NRS 0.031, which defines controlled substance, it defines controlled substance to mean, quote, a drug, immediate precursor, or other substance, which is listed in a schedule. And as you go to the trafficking statute itself, if you read that statute carefully, you'll see that every time that substance is referred to, it is referred to in the singular sense. It's not referred to in the plural form, which tends to suggest that the legislative intent was to use as the unit of prosecution the type of controlled substance possessed rather than just the mere act of possession.
Mr. Petty, didn't the legislature carve out marijuana? So they know how to carve out drugs if they want to. Why shouldn't we be looking at the umbrella of Schedule 1 substances, period?
I think because, for one reason, because the statute speaks in the singular term, and for another aspect of the statute, if you read the part that deals with mixing drugs, and in this case they mix heroin, but only as a charging decision, if you read that, what it says is, the statute reads, or any controlled substance which is listed as, any such controlled substance, or a mixture of such controlled substance. That word such, because it is a touch-tone word in the statute, I think is another indication that the legislature was speaking to the unit of prosecution being the type of substance and not just the act of possession.
Doesn't the mixture go to cut drugs?
Yeah.
As opposed to mixing different types of drugs?
This is not a mixture case. A mixture case, this court years ago in Sheriff B. Humboldt County versus Lane identified what a mixture case was and why it was appropriate to have those increased penalties even in mixed cases. But this isn't a mixture case because this was a charging decision, not any act done by Mr. Andrews.
Okay.
So our position this morning is essentially this, that with regards to Mr. Andrews, the state wrongfully combined the heroin and the methamphetamine weights to reach a level 2 threshold amount. We would ask the court to remand, vacate that, the sentence that he received. Remand, when I was first thinking about this case, I was thinking that, because we always think about new trials, but that probably wouldn't necessarily be necessary here because by virtue of the fact that the jury found Mr. Andrews guilty of the possession counts, they necessarily found him guilty of the amount of heroin and the amount of methamphetamine that was charged or could have been charged individually. So it was simply as a remedy being a remand for amended judgment in respect to level 1 trafficking counts and then new sentencing hearing. The argument that I'm advancing, I know it.
I'm sorry, you said counts?
It would be, if you remand this back, it would be 2 counts of level 1 trafficking. Again, but he faces the chance, I think the very real chance, of concurrent sentencing.
Have we ever, though, had somebody come up on one felony, reverse them, and have them leave with 2 felonies?
You know, there's only, I would hate to be the person who will go down in history as achieving that result. But that's what I'm asking you to do. I mean, I realize it seems awfully weird, but again, it's because in his case, it actually could potentially inure to his benefit. He has 2 counts, but 2 counts of a level 1 as opposed to a level 2 trafficking charge. Those penalties are significantly reduced. The fines that are associated are significantly reduced. More importantly, I think about that person out there who just has simple possession and then finds himself looking at a trafficking charge because the state has been allowed to combine weights to get over that threshold level.
Sorry.
I will tell you, the 2 cases I think, there are no cases in Nevada on this point, but the 2 cases I would ask you to look at, one is the Maryland case that I cited in my opening brief, Cunningham v. Stinney. The other case, I did not cite in my brief, but it is indirectly before you because I cited an unpublished Michigan case called People v. Jones. And in that case, the court cites the case entitled People v. Green. And People v. Green's analysis is pretty much close to the way I suggest to this court they should read the word such in the statute. And with that, unless you have questions for me, I'll reserve my time.
Could you comment on NRS 453-3385? Do you agree with the state that appears to be ambiguous? And if so, what's your view of the statute and how we should interpret it?
Well,
I want to ask you a question about Jones in a minute.
Okay. I think that the state... It is not, as I said, the statute is not absolutely clear as to what the unit of prosecution could be, except that I think by implication, if you read substance, the singular use of the word substance, you target that word such that I've highlighted, then the implication is that the legislature intended for it to be a type of controlled substance, not the mere act of possessing. If you thought that it was ambiguous and you wanted to do, and you went to look at the legislative history to see if you could find guidance, I suggest to you that there's very little guidance in the legislative history. This case, the statute was enacted in 1983. Senator Raggio was the main proponent of the statute. The legislative history shows the discussion focused primarily on what then, because it then contained a prosecutorial veto provision that was ultimately excised. The rest of it doesn't speak to this particular question at the beginning of prosecution. It really speaks to getting large-scale drug dealers off the street and using people to turn on them to get them. And that, back in 1983, because I was here then, back in 1983, that was the thing. We're going to have these draconian penalties for these kinds of charges because it will force people to go up the ladder and try to let it keep paying. And I think historically that probably hasn't happened.
Looking at any aspects of ambiguity, does Castaneda help in any regard?
Because Castaneda uses has the discussion about the various uses of the word any and a.
Yes.
I looked at that case, in fact I was reading on an airplane Saturday or Friday going down to Las Vegas, and at first I thought there might be something there, but I don't think that it does, because I think if you look at the Maryland case that I cited, Cunningham v. State, their discussion, the first discussion of the use of the word any and the article A in the context of a controlled substance statute is more helpful, at least from my perspective, than Castaneda.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Morning, Mr. McCarthy.
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Terry McCarthy from Washoe County District Attorney's Office. With me today is Marilee Cape, who's going to be doing the heavy lifting in this case. But I did want to make a couple very short comments. That is, we need a ruling. We deal with this rather intuitively, but we would like to do it right. Believe it or not, we do want to do things correctly, and so we don't want duplicitous charging instruments, we don't want multiplicitous charging instruments, we don't want to split them up artificially, and we don't want to combine these charges improperly, but we need a little bit of guidance. And the scenarios are limited only by the imagination of the drug-dealing community. There are places you can go to someone's house and it looks like a Walmart. You got your meth, you got your marijuana, you got your LSD, and I just dated myself, I think. But we need some help on this, and that's why we're asking this court to tell us the appropriate unit of prosecution. Sometimes it's easy. You got a stolen car, it's one car. But this is not so easy, and that's what makes your job difficult. We ask you for an answer. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Kate, who's going to suggest what the answer ought to be.
Good morning, Ms. Kate.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Marilee Kate, and I also represent the state of Nevada in this case. Today, the state is asking that you adopt the rule that where a defendant possesses multiple prohibited substances at the same time, in the same location, and from the same schedule, the weight of those substances may be aggregated to form one trafficking charge. There's three reasons to adopt this rule and affirm the conviction in this case. First, the Nevada statutory scheme for prohibited substances penalizes and defines the crimes by schedule, not the substance. Second, this position is consistent with the legislative intent that this court addressed in Lynn, indicating that the purpose is to deter large-scale distribution of these prohibited substances. And third, and finally, the public policy favors treating multiple prohibited substances from the same schedule the same way as an equal weight of just one of those substances.
Ms. King?
Yes.
Then when you use the word may, then would the district attorney's office, under your proposition, retain the ability then to charge separately?
So whether, I apologize, Justice Dicklich. So thank you for the question. No, I think that this rule actually will require our office and require the court to say the district attorney has, in order to aggregate, we have to show the same time and same place in order to be able to aggregate the charges here, or the substances. And so that's the rule that I'm asking that you adopt, because it really, because there are so many circumstances where you can come to a place and charge multiple substances, but maybe they are possessed at different times, different locations, and there's all kinds of different potential defenses or issues with that. And so this will limit that. It will encourage that our office has to look very specifically at the facts to say, okay, this case, it is at the same time, it's in the same location. And that actually, some of the cases cited by the appellant in their brief arose on a double jeopardy type of argument. And there, the courts said, they looked at their individual statutes, of course, but they also said there's some concept of policy that those cases, the substances weren't at the same time or place, and so there it supported separate charges.
I'm not sure, though, that it it would prevent you from asserting separate charges at the same time and the same date, different substances. Can you explain that a little bit more, why you think a ruling in that regard wouldn't require you to charge as one offense? You could still have the option of charging in multiple offenses, couldn't you? The way the statute reads.
Well, I think certainly the court could tell us that. You, as the justice can say, you know, if this is the circumstances, the only way you can charge, so that we don't get to the multiplicities, or we don't get double jeopardy issues, this is the way you have to charge under the reading of the statute. So I do, you know, it does seem, I understand that it may seem a little weird to carve this circumstance out, but this is a unique circumstance where he did possess the substances at the same time, the buy was to the same confidential informant, same money was used. It is different than, I think, even some of the cases cited by appellant where a substance is located in the home, but the individual, like in Cunningham, has a substance on the street, has some possession on the street. That is somewhat of a different scenario.
But then in that instance, would you be required to aggregate, or could the defense move to aggregate them? Would you have the ability to separate them if you wanted to?
So the rule we're asking for in that instance would indicate that no, we wouldn't be required to aggregate, but because they're separately possessed and separated by the location.
Well, let's say in our instance here.
Oh, in our instance.
Let's use these facts.
Okay.
So would you be required to aggregate these facts?
Yes.
Okay. And if you didn't, could the defense move to aggregate them?
Yes. Okay. And it's actually interesting the way the charges came up in this case. Originally, Mr. Andrews was charged with a level one trafficking with the combined methamphetamine and heroin, and a level two trafficking with the combined methamphetamine and heroin. And it looks, and my understanding of the record is that the level one trafficking charge was for the amount that was sold to the confidential informant, because that actually, the aggregate amount of methamphetamine and heroin there was approximately 4.5 grams. But then the level two trafficking charge was for the amount that was still in the house, in the kitchen drawer, and that was about 14.5 grams, so it got right over that level two. And then after the motion practice, the defendant, the appellant, had a discussion with the charging deputy that they would just proceed on one level two trafficking charge. So even though one concept, some of that weight was the sale amount and some was the possession amount, it actually did inure to his benefit because they did only proceed on the one level two trafficking charge.
I understand your argument, Ms. Kate, then this decision would be driven in part by what's contained within the schedule.
That's correct.
What troubles me is absence of much discussion or debate in the legislature about these what is contained within each of these schedules. I have a little bit of concern about resolving this case surrounding schedules and the drugs contained within those schedules. I'm not as confident that there's really been a debate with respect to that subject. I'll give you a couple of hypotheticals. As we know, the drug market, the drugs that people are accessing, changed dramatically over time. And a lot of our statutes are geared toward weights. That's the structure of our drug statutes. We really haven't, the legislature really hasn't evaluated whether that's a proper measure in years. But if we look at opioids, for example, or if we look at some other drugs, frankly, the weight of those drugs is not what makes them dangerous. It's the drug itself. If we adopt a rule that's structured around drugs within a schedule, I'm concerned about whether we really have adopted a rule that recognizes the reality of drug trafficking and drugs where the weight really isn't what's is a killer.
So I appreciate that question, Justice Hardesty. I think the legislature has actually determined that these substances, at least in Schedule 1, are dangerous. There's not a redeeming quality to these substances, heroin, meth. They're not a prescription drug, like a different...
It's apart Schedule 1 versus Schedule 2 versus Schedule 3. Has there been a debate? Is there a legislative history that segregates that? Here we're dealing with methamphetamine and heroin, both in Schedule 1, when, quite frankly, the weights aren't what drive the risk of death, for example, itself. Where is the legislative history that would cause this panel to say we should develop a unit of prosecution rule that focuses on the drugs contained within each of those schedules?
Just to try to see, I don't think the legislature did actually address that, but I do, you know, the Townsend case cited by appellant is interesting because the legislature in Alabama, that concerns a trafficking statute. Townsend is one of the only cases cited by appellant that actually addresses a trafficking statute. And interestingly there in Alabama, they have similar language as we do. They have the possession, sale, distribution. They recognize a mixture can create the trafficking level. But in Alabama, the legislature was very specific, and this is something that our legislature, if they do want us to separately treat these drugs, could do. They individually, in each subsection, divide out the drug. And so the overall principle is trafficking, and then subsection A deals with cocaine specifically, and how to penalize cocaine, possession of cocaine, trafficking of cocaine. And then the next subsection deals with methamphetamine. And so our legislature certainly could decide and revisit this issue and say, this is what, you know, now we do think there's more information out there about how dangerous each of these drugs is individually, and they could adopt a principle or a trafficking statute that models that algorithm, and then that's very clear. You're supposed to treat each substance separately. At least that's the reading I can take from Alabama, and that's the way the Townsend case interpreted the statute.
So I got from your brief that you thought 3385 is ambiguous.
I think with respect to the unit of prosecution, I think that's a fair assessment, yes.
It appears to coincide with Mr. McCarthy's remarks before we begin.
Yes.
Ordinarily, we would resolve those kinds of ambiguities in favor of the defendant.
That's true.
What about now? Seems like you're arguing for a position that doesn't favor the position of the defendant in a statute that alleged to be ambiguous.
Thank you for that question. So, 2 points. In Lange, this court recognized that when you're dealing with when you're dealing with these type of issues, you don't always favor the lenity argument. If it's conflicting with the legislative intent, you don't favor that. But as was the questions came out with Mr. Petty, there are circumstances where this rule would favor a defendant. This case, Well, in this case, they stipulated to only proceed on one charge, even though he potentially could have faced two trafficking charges, one for the sale amount and one for the possession amount. But, you know, as you look at the cases, as you look at some of the fact patterns, you could get a circumstance where the defendant is actually favored by this interpretation because he's not facing multiple trafficking convictions. He's only facing one.
What would be the hypothetical under your interpretation of the statute that would favor a defendant?
It would be when you deal with, specifically in level three, when you get up to that level when you're facing the 10 to life or 10 to 25 years, if you're dealing with multiple substances.
Part of the reason I posed the question dealing with weights, you got to be carrying around sacks of stuff to get to level three. And when you're talking about drugs that are real killers, like opioids and some of the more recent drugs on the street, Splenda package isn't going to ever get you to those levels. That's what concerns me about that interpretation. So to the extent that a defendant, the only defendants we're talking about that would be favorably impacted by that are those that are in Schedule 3 as trouble.
Well, under these facts, again, I think really the state could have proceeded on two trafficking charges for the different, for the sale and that. So he actually did benefit in this case by just the single level two offense. And so I do understand that in this particular circumstance where we're dealing with the level two versus level one, it does, when it's possessed at the same time, same location, it does seem to be detrimental to the defendant. But then I think we rely on Lynn, where the legislative intent is clear. These statutes were to come in and deter large-scale distribution, and we know that when you have multiple grams of these substances, that we're not talking about personal use. We're talking, you know, this is distribution.
Deterrence with respect to this subject come up in the context of sentencing rather than charging. The defendant in this case would be facing two charges of 1 to 6. The court could run those consecutively if based upon the ancillary facts surrounding this case, it was appropriate to give this individual 2 to 12. And in fact, the legislature, as you know, has adopted a change when there's consecutive sentencing and aggregated those themselves on the sentencing side. So Mr. Andrews could have been facing a 2 to 12 or something higher on the minimum side. Isn't this an issue that ought to be debated during the course of sentencing rather than in charging?
It could.
I've seen the state bring multiple counts. Take a sexual assault case or, a child pornography case. Justice Stiglitzer, Justice Castaneda, but, you know, 29 counts of child portrayal where you've got a video that displays the child or children multiple times, and so additional counts are added in one portrayal. Turning to this context, you could have easily charged this individual with multiple counts of possession of different Schedule I drugs for each of the different drugs, and then argue and debate to the sentencing judge the length of the sentence based upon consecutive sentences. What's wrong with that approach?
Then I think there's a disparity in the way that we're treating these substances and these offenses. So this defendant could get the 1 to 6 consecutive or concurrent time, but then somebody else who has methamphetamine, just methamphetamine, but they've got 14 grams or plus, they're being sentenced at the 2 to 15. And it does bring the court back to your question about how these substances, if it's appropriate to treat them in the same schedule. But under the statute we're dealing with, they are defined by schedule, and the legislature could certainly, in the future date, choose to distinguish the substances like they did in Alabama. And so in conclusion, I'd like to just request that the court affirm the judgment of conviction in this case, and that the court rule that a single amount of, or a single trafficking charge can be there if there's the same substances from the same schedule that are possessed at the same time, the same location, It's consistent with the way I view the statutory scheme, legislative intent addressed by Larry, public policy, and it will ensure that drug traffickers aren't rewarded for diversifying their products. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Kate from the panel?
No.
All right. Thank you. All right. Mr. Petty?
Thank you. Just a couple of points. The subject of the statutes with regards to schedules and how they are determined, what the legislature has said, and I don't have the statute in front of me, what the legislature has said is they set forth in the statute this test shall apply to Schedule 1, this test shall apply to Schedule 2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then they direct the pharmaceutical board or board to determine what controlled substances meet these aspects of those tests, and that's how it happens. And so you have heroin as a Schedule 1 drug, you have methamphetamine as a Schedule 1 drug, you have marijuana as a Schedule 1 drug. And
yes, go ahead.
So you have a variety of substances out there that are Schedule 1 drugs. The statute itself that we're talking about, the trafficking statute, you only have to possess a certain amount of one of those drugs to be in violation of this particular statute, which again lends credence to my argument that it is a substance-based approach, not a possession approach, as a unit of prosecution. And I'll simply indicate to the court the conclusion that in the Maryland case, Cunningham v. State, the court actually goes out of its way to collect cases and shows that there are basically three approaches. There is the approach where the courts have said every controlled substance possessed at a particular time is one unit of prosecution. Some courts have said, well, it depends on which schedule they are in, so you can combine similarly scheduled drugs. And then other courts, Maryland, and the argument that I'm making to this court today, say, no, it is the substance itself that becomes the unit of prosecution, not the mere act of possession. So I would ask the court to consider that, and if you have no more questions, thank you for your time.
Do we have any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Petty. And thank you, Mr. McCarthy, for your arguments here today. The case will stand submitted. Ladies